podcast is from the Kentucky Women Writers Conference, made possible by the University of Kentucky in Lexington. This poetry reading features Julia Johnson, a native of New Orleans and now Associate Professor of English at the University of Kentucky. She is followed by Kim Adonisio, who resides in Oakland, California. Adonisio concludes her portion with a blues harmonica performance. They are introduced by Kimberly Miller.
When you find yourself in horse country, how do you make yourself at home? Having joined the University of Kentucky's English faculty, poet Julia Johnson has become one of our own in the bluegrass writing community. In a poem like Transparent Horse from her new book, The Falling Horse, she begins with the listing of parts, an examination of process. A speaker and her lover assemble an anatomical model of a horse. In its details, some of this scene feels like a portrait of a 1950s couple putting together a child's bicycle on Christmas Eve. But a closer reading reveals a very different picture. In other details, the ears of the horse are missing. Johnson unveils for us a more intimate negotiation, the dismantling and reassembling of relationship. Please welcome our own Julia Johnson.
Thank you so much. I'm so honored to be here and to hear that introduction, which makes me feel so good about myself, which is a good feeling. Anyway, I'm going to read that poem, Transparent Horse. Equine anatomy fills the room. A muzzle at the edge of the rug. Its pastern between the coronet and fetlock. You are happy it is evening. The cannon bone is spectacular and sharp, and I hold the left one to the light. I like the stifle, and so I give it to you. The hoof upside down shows clearly the frog, the triangular area underside. We turn him to see the gas skin between the hock and the stifle. We place the wither and the neck like logs near the box it came in. You tell me about the check ligaments, a system that lock in position, allowing standing up sleep. The belly and the barrel need the joints before we can go on. I press my finger to the pole and the skull, slightly behind where ears would go if they were included. You cross the room with the tail in your hand. This transparent horse was given to me as a gift. It was bought at a place called Hudson's Treasure Hunt in Hattiesburg, Mississippi, in which things have fallen off of trucks, like dozens of transparent horses, and they're still in their shrink wrap boxes. It's a very wonderful place to shop if you're ever in Hattiesburg, Mississippi, or anywhere along the Gulf Coast. But things are sometimes scorched with, like, you know, soot because they've been in a fire, or maybe they've been in a flood. So it's a great place to buy toothpaste, you know, things that are still sealed. But that was given to me as a gift. It's kind of like the transparent man, I think. People maybe in the 70s had it. I don't think they really make those anymore. Or you can buy that at Toys R Us. Okay. Good to know. I'm going to read just a few more poems from this new book. And the book is called The Falling Horse. It was called that before I knew I was coming to Kentucky. And so I hope it doesn't offend anyone. I've since found out that it's a really horrible image to see a horse falling. And so I have actually seen a horse fall, but in the context of this book, it's a much more sort of metaphorical image. It's not a literal horse falling, at least not a non-plastic one. Okay, so the first poem in the book is called "She Finds Herself Looking." She cannot find it. The eye walked away, its shoes pointed outward, its flat hat flattened, covering its eyes. The eye was too lost to realize it would never be able to return. It could never find its way back again, blinded by opportunity. The severe burial of masks. I am almost thinking of the mat at the door, of the wagging of last summer's dog turning the corner, of thriving, of the wind never, of things left in the glove box, of the taken with us like holiday gifts, of the almost shaving of her waist, almost too soon, the cracked orbit of snakes, of the severe, of the almost at the altar, almost breathing at last, like a conditioned child, almost thinking of the burial of masks, of the pigs, of the station of stillness, of the falling horse, of this bridge of rainwater pails, of circling. Some of you, a couple of you anyway, in the audience know about my ongoing obsession with the painter Eve Klein. But for those of you who don't know about my obsession or about the painter Eve Klein, I should tell you that Eve Klein was a French artist who was obsessed himself with the color blue, the cobalt blue. And he would do very strange things, like cover a globe with thick blue paint. And that would be, that's one of his most famous sculptures, is called Blue Globe. And that would be it. He would also take nude models and put them against a canvas, actual models, and take out a blowtorch and get very close to them with the blowtorch. And there are many films of this. They're very kind of disturbing. And anyway, I find him really great. And so I wrote a series of poems about him, and I continue to kind of, I cannot really get him out of my head. But if you're not familiar with him, you should look him up. It's Eve Klein. And so I'm going to read this poem called Blue Globe. If you say the seas are blue, I'll believe you. If you say the lands that once there are also blue, I'll believe you. If you say the shape of the head slowly turning on its holder is perfectly round, I'll believe you. If you say to move the earth now is as easy as a spin, a flick of the finger, I'll believe you. If you say the truth, a globe on its holder is what holds us while we turn, I will believe you. Fire painting after Eve Klein. I cast you now a lengthened shape. The type does not move you. You are the bare and faceless announcement of this. And as on the shore of edges of color, I lap against you and out. I make every word for itself. You are stretched head in the proper position you have inherited. In your sleep, you're laid out, forever situated on the page, and the familiar image of you is conveyed in the patient's silence. It would not be fair to leave you in this immense territory. I'm going to read one more poem from The Falling Horse. It's called Woman in the Intricate City. She waited, driftwood body stung by a wasp, her folded hand like a knife. She was irritable, too, lifeless to wait any longer. The radio rattled, and she remembered her stroke in the stream. She turned like a top. In and then once out, she was bright as golden hair. The trees bristled in the open air. She looked back, the orange of her dress like an unpredictable peach. Her thumbs held to her shoulders. It was 12 o'clock. She worried about something other than her hands. They had helped her, she knew, in the brassiest and smallish way. The breeze died down around her smooth head. I'm working on a manuscript called Subsidence. It sort of deals with identity, metaphor, dreams. These are things that I deal with a lot in my poems, obviously. Domesticity, objects, quandaries, and also the kind of, I think, the role of a woman in this world that we live in. But this book is actually a book about Katrina, and my family was deeply affected by Katrina. My father lost everything. My mother was stuck in New Orleans during the storm, and obviously, you know, as a native of New Orleans, I've, you know, dealt with hurricanes many times, and this sort of idea of losing things has always been a kind of theme. But in this manuscript, it's the first time I'm kind of able to, in my own way, write about Katrina, even though, you know, for most people reading the poems, you may not even know that they're about Katrina. So that's why I'm telling you that. So I'm just going to read a few poems from that one, and then this odd sequence, and then I'll read an odd sequence that's not related to any book right now. I don't know what these poems are about, but I'm not going to read those right now. I'm going to read from Subsidence. I should say that these poems came about because I found a dictionary of geological terms on my husband's table at his work. He's a geologist. He's a sedimentary geologist. And I thought it was really kind of funny because I had never I've never studied geology, but also the terms are really bizarre, like elbow of capture, that's a geological term, and I thought, who made these up? And so I just stole these titles, the defining words, and then I wrote these poems, which actually are enormously about geology and about subsidence, which is actually the losing of land and the sort of ever-changing landscape of the Mississippi and Louisiana Gulf Coast. Minor fold. The channel is filling up with gray water and soft boats. I have wondered about the disposable shelf. This is trouble-free. The shoulder blades are even. I am used to their counterpoint matches. The wig is loose on my head. Spines of books, even from this near distance, are blurred and unreadable. I shuffle closer. The characters, of which there are eight, seem like curls of steam from the surface. At the coastline. Becky blasted us with bare nets. Her shifts were limitless and grassy. When she first appeared, we thought she was ghostly, a reversal of herself. Her light hair was stippled with blue. She understood us only by reading the way our mouths moved. We held our arms out under the cloudy sky. Her skiff leaned. Morphology. Hills of drape, the new roads wind through. The wagon wheels and the small of the road is upon us. You say wagon wheels and I crisscross. I sample the doubles. There is a way to write out what we mean. The hope that comes is terribly old. The water will not even sell. Bricks in buckets broken. Brave men straighten their sport coats in the forest that craves shade. And then this next set is actually, I know you all have all, you're all familiar with National Poetry Month. Well, I've been doing this marathon with some of my former students from the University of Southern Mississippi, and also my former colleague and friend, not former friend, current friend, Angela Ball. And we write a poem every day in April. And so I actually wrote 30 poems about how many days were in April? Does anybody know? 30. Okay, so I wrote 30 poems. They're all due by midnight by email, or else you're out. You can't continue in the marathon. I'm sure a lot of you have done this. But anyway, so I just decided that that I would do numbers, that every day would be a number. And so these are completely out of order, but now I have to write another probably 18 or 20. But anyway, I've just started looking at them again, and I think they're really kind of silly, but I just thought I'd read them because, well, I'm not going to read them all, but I'm going to read them until my time is up. Possible configurations. I learn of the unitary perfect, harmonic divisor, 4-bit binary. My mother told me 6 geese a-laying are given a present. And how do you know of the polydactyl hand? Lucky! Cells of a beehive honeycomb. Why not count them? The mole cricket spends its day in basements. Semi-perfect number. We won't concern ourselves with number theory today. Every practical number that is not a power of 2. We won't worry about the anti-meridium and post-meridium, the 12-hour clock developed over time. If only we had not done away with the analog dial, modeling the apparent motion of the sun. We shouldn't think of the complete revolution, the shadow of the sun tracing a path that repeats approximately once per day. We won't keep track of our side reel today, the regularity of the Earth's rotation. We won't worry that at midnight tonight, our side reel time will be 4 minutes later than last. These are supposed to be funny, but they're not. In one stroke is a curve. The magic number thinks the girl. Her fear of writing is years long. She remembers the unmoving stars in the sky perfectioning, a quaver, a percentage of a note, but she cannot be sure. The maids are milking. The girl counts her top row of teeth and counts them again. She finds herself wandering in pagodas. I'm going to read 2 more. The fiction we call real. I catch a stale rig in my hand. It is crooked and left rust. I told my cousin to wait for the same thing to happen to him. Burning sleeves in my dreams are always turning into tunnels, but my college friend knows I make up stories. I head down the street where they are mopping up after the parade. We slip into our white suits with shields for eyes. I wrap up the maidenhair tree in brown paper after cutting it down. The leaves are replicated on my living room walls. On a visit, I noticed my doctor's head had been painted with thick curls. Okay, last one. The effectivity of processes. We have found extraordinary sheep in the green hills, white on distant shapes, levels of paint in the seamless pond. We have found perfect fuses to limit the light. We have discovered cross-hatched saddles in the road. We have come to this blazoned. We have found safety in what is kept distant. Our hands are tied. We have found a mask the size of someone else's face, a map outlined in red, the shape of a sandal. We have found the direction now, an arrow 9 miles ahead. Thank you so much for listening to my poem.
In her poem, 31-Year-Old Lover, Kim Adonisio catalogs the attributes that make a speaker's younger male conquest such a visual delight. The sensory details here show us a man both consumable and delicious. When she writes that his undressing causes the speaker to think of a stick of butter being unwrapped, the reader's appetite for more, of the young lover, of the language of this poem, of this poet, is whetted. We're there. But, as in so much of Adonisio's brilliant, honest, and sensuous, and often sensual work, our greatest satisfaction is deferred until the poem's end. First, we are given the physical undressing of the younger lover, followed by a striptease of smart, anatomical language that cascades through the poem's middle. In the end, Adonisio delivers. The speaker lays herself bare, not to her 31-year-old lover, but more dangerously, to us and to herself. Kim Adonisio, thank you for this poem, and thank you for reading to us.
Thanks. Hi, everybody. Julia was saying something about the horse, the things that fell off trucks, and it just reminded me of a friend's mother who had a number of fur coats that had also fallen off a truck. So I would be remiss if I didn't read something with some four-letter words in it. This is called Introduction to Poetry. So I think it'll be appreciated by those who write poetry, which is probably everyone here, more or less. Anybody here who just appreciates poetry and doesn't actually write it? Wow, those are high numbers. Okay, great. So this is called Introduction to Poetry. Psychiatrists are not poetic. Neither is flatulence or anything involving the intestines. Breasts are more poetic than penises or vaginas or sunsets, but better a penis and a vagina than a sunset, especially a sunset over the glittering ocean over the craggy peaks. Rainbows, not an especially good idea unless your name begins with Elizabeth and ends with Bishop, and you are referring not to a rainbow, but to oil in a little rented boat. Oil has become more poetic than ever due to its listing in the thesaurus as a synonym for suffering. Which is more poetic, legless child, drowning polar bear, heartless lover? If your house was burning down, would you save A, your grandmother, B, the Picasso, see, your latest poem, the best and truest one you've ever written, which you will revise to include an elegy for your grandmother using a cubist metaphor. Sorry, I need water. Did I leave my water? No, it's right there. Thank you. For revision is poetic, though it seemeth not so. For thou shalt use no archaic diction, lest ye be stoned in the biblical sense of the word. For I must tell you again and again to show, for when you tell, ye are as rainbows at sunset arching over the breasts of beautiful women. For your ignorance is vast, but I assure you mine is vaster. For my selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor rises in the night sky among the starry fays. For a poem should not be mean. It should be darling as a lap dog, but never yap. A poem should only open its trap to praise and fuck anyone who says otherwise. Do not use the word fuck gratuitously. Come to think of it, the penis is perfectly poetic if used thusly. Oh, my mushroom, we are as microvilli in the body of the world. Its bleary incandescence, its corporations need to dress us like skeletons and hoard all the candy. The fucking shits. I love you so much, baby. No one should say that in a poem. Fuck, shit, love. Now write. That's my advice. Going to do a couple different things here. I'm going to read. I sort of have two new books because one is Lucifer at the Starlight that came out, I don't know, the last year or two. And the other is this book, Jimmy and Rita, that's been recently reissued that was first published in 1997 that's been reissued again. So it sort of feels like a new book and it has a new cover. And I'm really proud of the cover because I took the photo, and you know. So, I am going to start by reading some poems from Jimmy and Rita, and it's a novel in verse. So, I'm going to skip around a little bit, but read some of the early poems, and I think mostly the ones from Rita. Although I think I'm going to throw in one from Jimmy. Just to give you a little bit of an idea of the territory of who these characters are. December. For a while, Rita works at a massage parlor on Eddy Street. All she has to do is jerk them off, no fucking or kissing. She washes her hands 7-8 times a day. Dreams of scrubbing off skin, red strips of it falling into a sink full of suds. She buries what's left of her hands in the white froth, piled like new snow she would scoop out as a child to make a man. And this is when Rita and Jimmy meet, party. Rita leans against someone's kitchen table, doesn't know a soul here except Diane, who's listening to an old man. Sunglasses and a cigar, drunk. I'm not trying to take you to bed, but would I? In a minute. Rita wishing she could just go home, take a Valium, put on the TV. Need a drink, pretty lady? Jimmy slams the refrigerator and turns to her, grinning. Dark hair slicked back, blue eyes, St. Christopher medal dangling. His sweatshirt with the sleeves cut off, tattoo on his right bicep. Cartoon devil riding a panther. What's your name? Slow look from top to bottom. Rita closes her eyes to decide, then opens them, and he's across the room, his arm around a black girl. Later, Diane takes her into the bathroom, hands her a rolled 10. Rita leans to the toilet lid, goes out with her head ringing right up to him. Rita, she says. And he repeats it 3 times like a prayer. Rita, Rita, Rita. Where you been all my life, girl? Nowhere. Her lips are numb. She almost can't feel it when he kisses her. And this one is Jimmy. It's called Beer, Milk, the Dog, My Old Man. My old man used to take the dog out to the garage where the poker game was and set down a bowl of beer. That's the kind of thing he thought was funny. He used to give me some, too, and laugh when I threw up or fell over a chair. He taught me to fight by smacking the side of my head with his open hand, calling me a pussy. Don't let them give you any shit, he said. When he smacked my mother, she didn't hit back, just yelled at him. Once she threw a glass of milk at his head. It hit the wall and broke to pieces on the floor. I was 10 when he died, too young to figure it out. What I thought about was the milk on the kitchen floor that time, how they'd both left it there and gone to bed. The dog got to it and swallowed glass. My mother said the dog just got sick. The milk evaporated, she said, meaning it just went into the air. I thought, how could something be there and then not? Milk, the dog, my old man. He loved a cold beer. Sometimes I'd sit up at night in the garage and watch how he drank it, tipping his head way back, and I'd try to drink mine exactly the same, but quietly, so he wouldn't notice and send me away. This is called Fixing. Rita has a little heroin habit. If there's such a thing as a little heroin habit. I don't know. Fixing. Watching it boil in the spoon, then Jimmy draws it up for me, flicks the cylinder with his finger to get the air bubbles out, his belt's around my arm, buckle dug into my skin, the needle sliding in, my blood outside of me, then coming back sweeter, the first rush and his cologne smell hitting me together. He pulls back the plunger, his hands are steady, pushing it in again. I lost my glass needle. It's better than the plastic ones, but Jimmy's good. He's so good like that again, please. I look down at my arm, the tiny new mark, the older ones I cover with my hand, but he doesn't notice. He's cleaning the needle, squirting water across the table at me. Did you like that? He says. I let my head fall back, close my eyes. Yes, Jimmy, you're so... And I'll do just two more of these. This is called Fairmont. Rita's first time in San Francisco. 17 years old, with her brothers Jack and Charlie at the bottom of Powell Street, trying to buy Quaaludes. They went off down Market, and she rode the cable car to the top. She wanted to see the Fairmont Hotel. White limo in front, the doorman in his uniform. She felt shy sitting in the lobby, in her torn jeans and black sweater. But nobody paid any attention, except one man, blonde hair in a gray suit, who offered a drink. I can't, I'm too young. And then 50 if she'd go somewhere with him. He took her across the street to an office building, into a tiny bathroom, fucked her over the toilet. Then he left, to get his wallet, he said. Rita waited, then walked out down a red carpeted hall, past two receptionists, crying even in the crowded elevator. Back at the turnaround, she found her brothers gagged down two pills without water. Where'd you go? Jack asked. I just realized how that sounds. Jack asked. Rita wouldn't say. She knew they'd tell her she was stupid not to get the money first. They sat down by Woolworths, music from a saxophone loud in their ears, Rita waiting until the shame went away, and the other girl came, the one with the same name, but no memories. And I'll do just one more from this book. Jimmy, I don't think I'm giving too much away of the plot by saying that Jimmy lands in jail at one point. We did this up in Port Townsend with music, and it was really great. There will be a little music at the end of today, too, because I would also be remiss if I didn't play some harmonica. But I did it with this poet named Gary Lilly, and he's got this just great, deep, very Barry White kind of voice, you know. And he did this poem the way I could never do it. And as I read it, it's such a, you know, pale white girl imitation of his beautiful resonant voice, the way he read this poem. And we had guitar and harmonica behind it. But It's also a kind of a visual poem. It's in columns. Inside. Dinner tray, cigarette, cement yard, stars. Walls, magazine, cigarette, sleep. Dreams, walls, spoons, tattoos. Cigarette, shadow, toilet, cement yard. Guards, movie, cigarette, sleep. Toothbrush, photograph, harmonica, walls. Dinner tray, cigarette, cement yard, stars. And I'm going to turn to the new book as opposed to the new old book, which is Lucifer at the Starlight, and read you a sampling of poems from that. This is this poem has a lot of exclamation points in it, and you'll kind of hear it in the voice. And I think that's really all you need to know. Nadia, Saraya, Nala, Hoda, Noor are Iraqi women's names. November 11th, 2004. Oh, everyone's dead, and the rain today is marvelous. I drive to the gym. The streets are slick. Everyone's using their wipers. People are walking with their shoulders hunched, wearing hoods or holding up umbrellas. Of course, it's all to be expected. Fantastic. My mother's friend Annie, her funeral's today. The writer Iris Chang, she just shot herself. And Arafat, he's dead too. The doctors refuse to say what killed him. His wife is fighting with the Palestinians over his millions. The parking lot of the gym is filled with muddy puddles. I run 4.3 miles per hour on the treadmill, and they're dead in Baghdad and Fallujah, Mosul and Samarra and Latifia. Nadia and Saraya, Nala and Hoda and Noor, their husbands and cousins and brothers, dead in their own neighborhoods. Imagine! Marine Staff Sergeant David G. Reese, 29, Clark, Washington, killed. Army Specialist Kwok Bin Tran, 26, Mission Viejo, California, killed. Army Specialist Brian L. Freeman, 31, Lumberton, New Jersey, same deal. Marine Lance Corporal Jeffrey Larne, 22, New York. You guessed it. Oh, I could go on and on for as long as I live. In Africa, too, they've been starved and macheted. The morning paper said the Serbs apologized for Srebrenica. 7,800 Muslims murdered in 1995. I know it's old news, but hey, they're still dead. I almost forgot my neighbor's niece, 16 and puking in Kaiser Emergency, the cause of big mystery until the autopsy. Toxic shock syndrome of all things. I thought that was history too, but I guess girls are still dying. Who knew? I run for 2 miles. My knees hurt and my shins. I step off and stretch for a bit. I go back outside into the rain. It feels chilly and good. It goes on all day, unending and glorious, falling and filling the roof gutters, flooding the low-lying roads. This is called For You. For you, I undress down into the sheaths of my nerves. I remove my jewelry and set it on the nightstand. I unhook my ribs, spread my lungs flat on a chair. I dissolve like a remedy in water, in wine. I spill without staining and leave without stirring the air. I do it for love. For love, I disappear. And I want to do this one too. It's funny, it almost feels odd to read without music now because I've really been working music in various ways into my readings, but since I can't play harmonica and speak at the same time, or play flute and speak at the same time, which is the other instrument I play, it's a little tough on my own. And so I'm kind of, you know, working more and more with musicians. But this is one that we do kind of interspersed with a Gillian Welch song, if any of you know Gillian Welch. So it's also, I like to call this a Dorothy Parker poem on steroids. Dorothy Parker has a little four-line poem that goes, some men break your heart in two, some men fawn and flatter, some men never look at you, and that cleans up the matter. I'm a big fan of Dorothy Parker, and I'm going to do some of her stuff tomorrow, too, in my lecture. But so she has this little four-line poem called Experience, and so I took that and made a much longer poem out of it, and you'll hear, but you'll hear those lines or versions of those lines blip in. So the matter. Some men carry you to bed with your boots on. Some men say your name like a verbal tick. Some men slap on an emotional surcharge for every erotic encounter. Some men are slightly mentally ill and thinking of joining a gym. Some men have moved on and can't be seduced even in the dream bars where you meet them. Some men who are younger are now the age you were then. Some men aren't content with mere breakage. They've got to burn you to the ground. Some men you've reduced to ashes are finally dusting themselves off. Some men are made of fiberglass. Some men have deep holes drilled in by a war. You can't fill them. Some men are delicate and torn. Some men will steal your bracelet if you let them spend the night. Some men will want to fuck your poems, and instead they will find you. Some men will say, I'd like to see how you look when you come, and then hail a cab. Some men are a list of ingredients with no recipe. Some men never see you. Some men will blindfold you during sex, then secretly put on high heels. Some men will try on your black fishnet stockings in a hotel in Rome, or saran wrap you to a bedpost in New Orleans. Some of these men will be worth trying to keep. Some men will write obtuse, condescending reviews of your work, making you remember these lines by Frank O'Hara. I cannot possibly think of you other than you are the assassin of my orchards. Some men, let's face it, really are too small. Some men are too large, but it's not usually a deal breaker. Some men don't have one at all. Some men will slap you in a way you'll like. Some men will want to crawl inside you to die. Some men never clean up the matter. Some men hand you their hearts like leaflets, and some men's hearts seem to circle forever. You catch sight of them on clear nights, bright dots among the stars, and wait for their orbits to decay, for them to fall to earth. And I think I should probably close about now. So what I'm going to do, I'm going to read one other poem that isn't mine, but since this is a women writers conference, and since it segues so nicely into my harmonica train song, I want to read you a poem by Ruth Stone, which is called Train Ride. And then I'm going to do you my version of a train song. All things come to an end. Small calves in Arkansas, the bends of the muddy river. Do all things come to an end? No, they go on forever. They go on forever, the swamp, the vine-choked cypress, the oaks rattling last year's leaves, the thump of the rails, the kite, the still white stilted heron. All things come to an end. The red clay bank, the spread hawk, the bodies riding this train, the stalled truck, pale sunlight, the talk goes on forever. The wide, dry field of geese. A man stopped near his porch to watch. Release, release. Between cold death and a fever, send what you will, I will listen. All things come to an end. No, they go on forever. That's Ruth Stone, Train Ride. So, I will close this out with a train song. Thank you.
This has been a presentation of the Kentucky Women Writers Conference and the University of Kentucky. We would like to thank LexArts, the Kentucky Foundation for Women, and the Carnegie Center for Literacy and Learning for supporting these endeavors. For more information, please visit KentuckyWomenWriters.org.